Om sahana vavatu, sahanao bhunaktu, sahavirnyan karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. Kataksha kirana chanta naman mohabdhaye namaha ananta nanda krishnaya jagan mangala murtaye. Good. Welcome back to our Vedanta class on Lakshmidhara's Advaita Makaranda. In the prior class, we had really quite a nice discussion demonstrating how your consciousness is necessarily the unchanging observer of all the changing activities of your body and mind. The point we made in some detail is if your consciousness changed, if it changed in synchrony with your mind, for example, the example I gave is if, as sadness entered your mind, if your consciousness simultaneously became sad, then how would you detect the presence of sadness in your mind? You might remember I gave the driving the car and drinking coffee example. I won't go through all that again. But we established in quite some detail in a prior verse that your consciousness is unchanging. If consciousness is subject to change, Vedanta is useless because a changing consciousness will always be subject to suffering. Only an unchanging consciousness can be totally free from suffering, and that's what we are discovering through these verses. We'll continue with the next verse. Tena tena hi rupena, tena tena hi rupena, jayate liyate muhuhu, jayate liyate muhuhu. Vikari vastu tasyaisham, vikari vastu tasyaisham, anusandhatrata kutaha, anusandhatrata kutaha. Tena tena hi rupena jayate liyate muhuhu. This is a reference to the prior verse in which we discussed the shad vikara. I'm not going to write it on the board again. It was all up on the board last week. The shad, the six vikara, the six kinds of modifications anything can go through. And we said those six modifications were jayate, it is born, asti, it continues to exist, vardhate, it undergoes growth, viparinamate, it undergoes change, apakshiyate, it undergoes decline, decay, and finally, nashyati, it is destroyed. So this is the typical Vedantic analysis of six kinds of change or six kinds of modification that any, in the third line, any vikari vastu, any vastu thing, which is vikari, subject to change, any vikari vastu is subject to these six kinds of change, these six kinds of modification. Now we're going to concentrate on two of those modifications. Jayate, to be born, to come into existence, and nashyati, to cease to exist, to be destroyed. And just looking at this verse, we're going to restrict our discussion a little bit here. We said in the prior verse that your consciousness is the unchanging observer of the changes of your body and mind. Now, by this point in our life, we're a little bit ready to understand the changes in our body, and it's easier to discern that you are separate and independent of your physical body. It turns out that to disidentify with your physical body is much easier than to disidentify with your mind. And the reason for that, I suppose, is a matter of proximity, space. There seems to be more space between consciousness and your body. Actually, your body starts down there and ends up here. So your body fills quite a volume of space. And that space that the body fills seems distant to some extent, distant from consciousness, the conscious observer. That's your true nature, Sakshi, Chaitanya, the witness consciousness. On the other hand, what is the space between your mind and consciousness? What is the space between thoughts and consciousness? There is, in terms of experience, there seems to be some space between body and consciousness, but between mind and consciousness, between thoughts and consciousness, between sadness and consciousness, there seems to be no space, no distance whatsoever. And that lack of distance, that close proximity, leads to the fact that we become much more identified with our minds, with our thoughts and emotions, as compared to our bodies. In our process of Vedantic inquiry, most people, we find it, not most people, I think just commonly speaking, we find it much easier to break free from identification with the physical body, but much more difficult to break free from identification with our minds. So we're going to restrict our discussion here to the mind, not the body. And so with regard to the mind, tena tena hi rupena jayate liyate muhuhu vikari vastu. So a vikari vastu, like your mind, a changing, I'm just looking at all my I scribble on these pages a lot, and then I have to interpret my scribble. Let me introduce this a little bit more thoroughly by saying that the here the objection, very specifically, the objection is maybe it's the mind that observes the mind. In a prior verse, we said that a changing mind can only be observed by an unchanging conscious observer. But there are some schools of thought that don't accept the existence of an unchanging conscious observer, such as schools of Buddhism. They don't accept that there is an unchanging conscious observer of the changing conditions of the mind or of anything whatsoever. So from the Buddhist standpoint, then the Buddhists would then explain that your mind observes the mind. The changes of your mind are observed by your mind. This is the objection that is being dismissed by this verse. Remember, the structure of this whole text is mostly manana, this process of the way it works is to introduce a doubt and then to dismiss it. Remember the example we gave early on of shaking the post in the ground and then making it, filling in more earth, shaking the post again and doing that repeatedly to make that post very steady. That's the process we're engaged in, the process of manana. So that vikari vastu, that changing thing, your mind, tena tena hi rupena, due to its various changes, tena tena rupena, due to assuming various forms, and forms here refers to cycling through those six kinds of modifications. So thoughts jayate, thoughts arise, thoughts asti. Thoughts exist for a period of time. Thoughts vardhate can grow more larger, more compelling in our mind. Thoughts viparinamate, thoughts can transform from one thought into another. Thoughts apakshiyate, thoughts can fade away. And finally, thoughts nashyati, can be destroyed, can go away entirely. So all these changing conditions in your mind Esham, for those, this is in the third line, Esham, for those six kinds of modification, Tasya, for the mind that observes the six kinds of modification, Kutaha, in the last line, how Anusandhatrata, how could there be Anusandhata, is observer. Anusandhatra, the undeclined form, Anusandhata, the observer. Anusandhatrata, the state of being an observer. Tasya, for that mind. Tasya, for the mind, Anusandhatrata, the state of being the observer. Kutaha, how can it be? How can the mind be the observer of the six changing conditions, the six modifications of the mind? Now, this presumes that you understand some of the logic involved in change. And let me make it very clear here. So the two changes we're focusing on is jayate, a thought arises, and nashyati, a thought goes away. In order for the mind to observe the birth of a thought, and here we need to define mind. And the Vedantic definition of mind is too simple. Mind is thoughts. Mind is vrittis. Vrittimat manaha. Your mind is that which is the locus of vrittis, thoughts. Mind is mental activities. So it's a very behavioral definition. Whatever we call mind, mind is thoughts. Not just intellectual thoughts, but including emotions and sensations. So here, how can the mind observe itself is the topic. And here, there's a technical objection hinted at in this verse. Not hinted, it's pretty clear. And that is, in order for the mind to observe the arising of a thought or the disappearance of a thought, or really speaking, any of the six changes, how can the mind observe itself? Especially with the, let me finish up my prior train of thought. To observe the arrival of a thought, the mind has to be present before the thought. Now, what is that mind present before the thought? We just said mind is thoughts. Before the thought, there's no thought. And now at this point, and I know this sounds a little convoluted, how does the mind know the mind? Commonly, people will suggest, well, suppose there one thought observes another. This is a very common objection. Suppose one thought observes the other. Of course, when you use the term suppose, you can suppose anything. You know, suppose the moon is made of cottage cheese. You know, so this, in fact, we'll talk about that word suppose with the next verse. Anyway, suppose one thought observes another. Is that your experience? Right now, observe what's happening in your mind. Tell me, is it a thought observing what's happening in your mind? Or you, the conscious, awareful being, observing what's happening in your mind? You see the point? mind can't observe itself. Mind can't observe, in fact, all six of these modifications can't be observed by the mind, because the mind can't observe itself. One thought can't observe another thought. The sun cannot illumine itself. A lamp cannot illumine itself. You get the idea that there's a subject-object relationship between you, the conscious observer, unchanging conscious observer, and your thoughts, that which is observed. So, since one thought can't observe another thought, why? That's not your experience. You don't by the way, just to explore that a little bit further, if A is observed by B, thought A is observed by B, then you can see what's going to happen. Then why not thought B is observed by thought C? Thought C is observed by thought D. We have this endless sequence. Often when we end up with this endless sequence, that's a logical fallacy. But regardless of whether or not it's a logical fallacy, is that your experience? Do you experience a thought, observing a thought, observing a thought? Or is your experience much more simple? You are the conscious observer of the activities of your mind. So, in this way, we dismiss the possibility of a thought observing a thought, and therefore we conclude there must necessarily be an unchanging conscious observer, Chaitanya Atma, the Atma, the self, which is Chaitanya consciousness, which is the unchanging light of awareness that illumines all the changing activities in your mind. And in this way, we dismiss this argument of the Buddhists that the mind observes the mind, or one thought observes another thought. The next verse is also, let's see, the next verse also deals with deals with objections of Buddhists. And in fact, before we see the verse, can I introduce this idea, this logic behind the word suppose? This is actually used. I'm just trying to think of the order in which it would make more sense to introduce this. In this next verse, which we'll see in just a moment, the objector, the opposing point of view, the objection, purva paksha, is a term we used before, is from a particular kind of Buddhist known as a vijnanavadi. Since I'm using some Sanskrit terms that might be unfamiliar to you, let me put some of these terms up on the board. So we're now dealing with an objection from a particular kind of Buddhists. There are actually four major schools of Buddhism. So we're talking about one of the four major schools of Buddhism. Vijnanavada is means a doctrine. So this is a doctrine of Vijnana. This is a doctrine of Buddhists that again want to deny an unchanging conscious observer. And what they posit is that as a thought arises, consciousness simultaneously arises. Very clever. That as a thought arises, the knownness, the consciousness that observes or reveals that thought, is simultaneously arises. And as the thought fades away, the consciousness fades away along with that thought. So therefore, consciousness, according to this Vijnanavada, consciousness is, the term they use is kshanika. momentary. Momentary consciousness. Of course, in Vedanta, we're establishing here that consciousness is unchanging. This school of Buddhism wants to say the opposite, that consciousness exists only momentarily. When a thought arises, consciousness arises. As a thought fades away, consciousness fades away. This is called Kshanika Vijnanavada, the school of thought called Vijnanavada that teaches that Atma is Kshanika, momentary. Consciousness is momentary. The other reason I came to the board is to introduce this style of argumentation based on the word suppose. The next verse, which we'll see in just a moment, is going to take the Buddhist point of view and say, suppose consciousness is Kshanika. Suppose consciousness indeed arises when a thought arises, and that consciousness fades away when a thought fades away. The verse begins by adopting the Buddhist point of view and then demonstrating why it doesn't work. This is a commonly used style of refutation, used not just in Vedanta, but used everywhere. But there's a special name for it. I'd like you to know this name because it's used quite a bit. The style of argumentation in which you assume the opponent's point of view and then demonstrate its flawed character. This assumption is called Abhyapeya Vada. Abhyapeya Vada. Just check my notes and make sure I didn't misspell that. Yeah. Abhi Appa E. I'm just breaking it down into its root forms. Abhyapeya, abhyapeta is another form. Abhyapeya vada is a vada, a style of argumentation in which you do this assumption of the opposing point of view and show the flawed nature of that point of view. All right. Come back here. And with that introduction, we are ready. Nacha swajanmanashamva. Nacha swajanmanashamva. Drashtum arhati kashchana. Drashtum arhati kashchana. Thau hi praguttara bhava, thau hi praguttara bhava, charama pratamakshanao, charama pratamakshanao. So, if you presume that consciousness arises with a thought and consciousness disappears with a thought, but that consciousness reveals the presence and absence of your own thought. So put it in terms of your own experience. Right now, you're experiencing so many changing conditions in your mind. So the Buddhist point of view, the Vijnanavada point of view, is consciousness arises and undergoes all these changes simultaneously with your thoughts, and that Kshanika Chaitanya, that momentary consciousness, is able to reveal all the changing conditions of your mind. That is the Buddhist point of view, which we have temporarily adopted for the sake of disproving it. And here comes the refutation. He says, in the second line, and you have to take the na from the first line, and take that down to the second line. Na drashtum arhati kashchana. Na drashtum arhati. It is not possible. Kashchana, for anyone. No one arhati can drashtum, can observe. No one can observe, in top line, swajanma, one's own creation, nasham va, or one's own destruction. Now, notice what this is referring to. If consciousness arises with the thought, consciousness disappears with the thought. That consciousness, let us say, the consciousness inheres in the thought. It is a conscious thought. And as that the thought with consciousness in it, that thought arises, that thought with consciousness in it fades away. So now we have to, according to the Buddhists, okay, no problem, let it be. You know, that conscious thought arises, that conscious thought disappears, that's your experience. And we say, no, that's not your experience at all. How can you observe the thought arise if consciousness only starts when a thought starts? How can you observe the thought go away if consciousness is gone after the end of the thought? And I'm going to explain this in detail. In fact, he explains it using some fairly complex logic. He says, so here the first half of the verse says, it is impossible to observe your own, you know, swajanma, swanasham, to observe your own creation, own destruction, meaning it's impossible to observe a conscious thought arising and a conscious thought disappearing. This is the Buddhist contention. It is impossible if, let me rephrase that, if consciousness arises and goes away with a thought, it is impossible to observe that thought. I make it more complicated than it is. So it's not so complicated. If consciousness arises with a thought and consciousness disappears with a thought, if that were the case, what the Buddhists propose, it would be impossible to observe that thought. Why? Third line, he, because, and now we get this tricky logic, because tao kshanao, because of tao, those two what? At the end, last line, kshanao, those two moments. What are the two moments? And now we got this compound, we have to really wire it together properly. I'm going to go to the board in just a minute to explain this. Prag abhava is the charana kshana. Oh, look at this. For those of you who like to work on compounds, look at this. Prag abhava is the charana kshana, and uttara abhava is the pratama kshana. So the very language is very complex here. It introduces two concepts you may not have seen before and are very important concepts. Prag abhava and uttara abhava is not the most common term. We need to go to the board for this one. And a diagram can make this so much more clear. So let this be the rise and fall of a thought. By the way, I was trained in computer engineering, so this is going from a zero to a one to a zero. When I see this, that's what I think. But so this is time, the axis of time. And here we go from no thought to a thought, back to no thought. So this realm is a realm of a thought. And we said that the Buddhist position is that consciousness arises. So at this leading edge, consciousness arises simultaneously with the thought. And at this trailing edge, consciousness disappears with the termination of the thought. And according to Buddhists, if this is how your mind works, you should be able to observe thoughts. And here we're refuting it. It's absolutely impossible. Why? And now we need to introduce these two terms. There are two conditions in which there is no thought. Thought is present here, but this is the prior absence of the thought. Prior absence, and that is the, we need the Sanskrit terms now, pragabhava. I hope you can read that. Prag means prior, prak is the word meaning before. Pragabhava becomes pragabhava, prior non-existence. So this state before the thought begins is called pragabhava, a state of prior non-existence. And then here, after the thought goes away, we have a state of posterior absence. This is in Western logic, the term he used was uttara abhava, but that's not the standard term. Uttara abhava means posterior absence, but the standard term is pradvansa abhava. Pradvansa means destroyed. Pradvansa abhava is a condition of non-existence after something has been destroyed, after something has disappeared. In the verse he uses uttara, meaning later. So uttara abhava and pradvansa abhava mean exactly the same thing, posterior absence or non-existence. But the standard term in logic is pradvansa abhava. Now, Here's the argument. And let me give you the argument and then we'll see if we can make heads or tails out of the Sanskrit. He does it very tersely in the last half of the verse. Here's the problem. If you want to observe the arising of a thought, the observer has to observe this leading edge. To observe the leading edge means it has to exist before the thought exists, but this is a period of pragabhava. There is the absence of the thought and absence of consciousness prior to this leading edge. So if consciousness is also absent at the moment this thought begins, there is no way to observe the arising of the thought. And similarly, to observe the cessation of a thought, to observe that it's gone, means you have to observe after the thought has come to an end. But after the thought has come to an end, consciousness has also come to an end. There's no consciousness present here. There is pradvansa abhava or uttara abhava, and because of that posterior non-existence, there's no consciousness here to observe the cessation of the thought. So this is the logic, and this logic requires us to know these two terms. Pragabhava is prior non-existence, and pradvansa abhava is posterior non-existence. These terms are used a lot in logic, and then sometimes Vedanta will make use of these terms to explain something. Now let's see if we can understand the verse. Okay. And you may not be able to decode the Sanskrit unless you're quite skillful at Sanskrit language, because he's being extraordinarily terse to convey this complex idea in this half of verse. First half of the verse says it's not possible to observe the creation and destruction of a thought. If consciousness arises with the thought and consciousness disappears with the thought, as the Vijnanavada Buddhists claim, then it is impossible to observe the beginning and end of a thought. Why? In the third line, he, because tau kshanau, because of those two moments. What are the two moments? The charama kshanau, the last moment, and the pratama, the first moment. And here, the charama kshanau, the last moment, the last moment of the exist, gosh, this is hard to do, the last moment of the existence of consciousness is pragabhava. It is the prior non-existence. And the pratama kshana, and the first moment of consciousness, falls afterwards, but that is uttara abhava, posterior absence. The Sanskrit is extremely terse here. Let me go back to the board, and I think you got it before, but we'll just see it one more time. The Sanskrit is very dense, terse here. The concept is not so difficult, though. Here's the point. If consciousness arises with the beginning of a thought, if consciousness disappears with the end of a thought, and that's exactly what Vijnanavada Buddhists teach, then here's the problem. Prior to the thought, there is the pragabhava, the prior non-existence of consciousness. If consciousness doesn't exist in that charama kshana, in that last moment before the thought begins, if consciousness doesn't exist then how can consciousness observe? Who's going to observe the beginning of the thought? And similarly, in the pratama kshana, the first moment after the thought goes, to observe the thought's ending, the first moment after the thought goes away, there has to be consciousness there. But there's no consciousness there after the thought has gone away because of the pradvansa abhava, the posterior non-existence of consciousness. The concept is not as complicated as the language. This is the language of logic. It might be new for you, but these are kind of important technical terms to know. The concept is very clear, however, and that is the Buddhist contention that your consciousness is momentary. When a thought arises, consciousness arises. When a thought goes away, consciousness goes away. This is a major Buddhist doctrine, and it doesn't stand up to logic, and it doesn't stand up to experience. It doesn't stand up to logic for the reasons we just gave. Consciousness would have to precede the thought to observe its arising. Consciousness would have to exist after the thought concludes to observe the cessation of the thought, and logically it's untenable. So we use logic then to dismiss this possibility, also in terms of your experience. So also in terms of experience, do you experience yourself as little, actually this ends up being a big debate, is your consciousness seamless or does it come in little lumps? This is like, and I don't want to get too sidetracked here, like the debate in science between the wave nature of energy and the particle wave of energy. So waves are continuous and particles are discontinuous. Of course, energy is both. But now if we apply that to consciousness, which is consciousness? Is consciousness continuous like a wave, or does it come in little blotches, little blobs of consciousness, little moments of consciousness, flickers, the common translation, flickers of consciousness? Is that your experience? Is your consciousness flickering, or is your consciousness continuous? So this is the argument from experience. Notice we have an argument based on logic and an argument based on experience with both of these arguments, and we refute the Buddhist point of view. Oh, and there's one more point I need to make here. Let me come back here. So this argument applies not just to jayate and nasyati. It doesn't apply only to the origination of something and the dissolution, cessation of something, which are two of the six shadvikara, two of the six modifications. This whole argument can apply to any of the six. For example, this could be the beginning of vardhate, beginning of growth. This could be the end of a period of growth. This could be the beginning of a period of change. This could be the end of a period of change. This could be the beginning of a period of decay. This could be the end of a period of decay. So even though we've used this logic to dismiss a possibility with regard to jayate and nasyati, the two of the six modifications of origination and dissolution, but really speaking, this argument can apply to all six. Okay. That's quite an interesting discussion. Hope you enjoyed that. Okay, we can see one more verse.
Na prakashe hamit yuktir, na prakashe hamit yuktir, yat prakasha nibandhana, yat prakasha nibandhana, swaprakasham tamatmanam, aprakasha katam sprashet, aprakasha katam sprashet.
Each one of these verses is a refutation of a possible argument. This is our manana. And here's the argument. And by the way, in the commentary that I've been following on this text, the commentator actually spends sometimes more time introducing the verse with by giving the objection that the verse responds to. Sometimes the commentator will spend more time on that introduction than the commentator actually spends on the verse itself. So these introductions are quite important, and I study all that before the class. And so here the commentator makes it very clear. What is the objection for which this verse is the answer? The objection is this. In Advaita Vedanta, the solution to the problem of suffering is jnanam, knowledge. Knowledge which covers your true nature, knowledge which prevents you from recognizing the fact that your consciousness is unchanging, and that unchanging consciousness is utterly unaffected by anything. It's not subject to suffering. So that ignorance that prevents you from recognizing the unchanging nature of your consciousness, that ignorance is removed by jnanam, knowledge. But the argument goes, when knowledge destroys ignorance, as an newly enlightened person, you still have a body and mind. Or let us say, the body and mind continue to exist. After knowledge destroys ignorance, body and mind continue to exist, obviously. But now, here's the issue. Your body is constantly decaying. Your mind is also subject to its own problems. And one thing that struck me in preparing for class today is this argument can be applied to many people ask this particular question, and that is, what happens when an enlightened person later in life suffers from dementia? So due to dementia, which is a problem, so the enlightened person, is the enlightened person subject to cancer and other illnesses? The body of the enlightened person is absolutely subject to cancer and other problems. How about the mind? Is the mind of an enlightened person subject to Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia? Absolutely true. So now the argument comes, well, wait a minute. If the enlightened person, let's take one by one. If the enlightened person's body gets cancer, how will the enlightened person deal with it? That you can answer, right? The enlightened person is detached, disidentified is a word we used before. The enlightened person doesn't identify with the body that suffers from cancer. So cancer belongs to the body. Cancer doesn't belong to consciousness. You get that very clearly. But now this Alzheimer dementia issue is much more tricky. When an enlightened person gets dementia, suppose the dementia affects the mind in such a way that the enlightened person forgets all about Vedanta. I won't say the enlightened person, the mind no longer has access to Vedantic wisdom. That's a much more precise way of putting it. The enlightened person, the mind, I have to watch the language very carefully here, the mind of the enlightened person, that mind, because the brain is affected by Alzheimer's disease, remember Alzheimer's dementia, these are physiological disorders of the brain that have consequences, of course, for the way our minds work. So Alzheimer's affects the brain. The result in the mind we call dementia, and that dementia can include losing access to all of the Vedantic wisdom that this enlightened person gained. So then the question is, does the person cease to be enlightened due to dementia, due to this defect of the brain? Now, and here's the logic is simple, but experientially it's a little bit more tricky. The logic is very simple. The defect of the body belongs, the cancer of the body belongs to the body, not to the consciousness, which is your true nature. The defect of the brain, Alzheimer's is a physiological problem. The defect of the brain is part of the body. It belongs, Alzheimer's belongs to the brain and not to consciousness. But what about this dementia part? The fact that the mind can lose access to the wisdom of Vedanta, does that mean that enlightenment goes away? And here's our author's response. He says, Na prakashe ham iti uktihi. Suppose someone says, aham, I, na prakashe. Literally, I do not shine, but the sense is, I am not conscious. So na prakashe hum. Hum is aham, I. Iti, thus, uktihi, statement. Ukti is a statement. So suppose there is an ukti, a statement. Suppose someone says, na prakashe hum, I am not conscious. So that statement obviously is born of ignorance, right? No one intelligent can say, I am not conscious. But you might imagine someone badly affected by dementia, perhaps such an idea could arise. You know, I'm like a rock, I'm inert, I'm not a conscious being. So suppose that demented mind has the thought, I am not conscious. What is our author's response? Yat prakasha nibandhana uktihi. That statement, I am not conscious, is nibandhana. It is dependent upon prakasha, consciousness. To have the thought, I am not conscious, that thought depends on consciousness. So when you say, I am not conscious, if some demented person says, I am not conscious, that doesn't indicate that consciousness is gone, does indicate that correct thinking is gone due to ignorance. So the thought, I am not conscious, is prakasha nibandhana, is dependent on consciousness itself. Then, by the way, my translation is not very, very good here. So I would make the first two quarters is one sentence. The second two quarters is a second sentence. So that self-shining self should really connect to the last line. I'll show you how. So since, in the first half, since a demented person who says, I am not conscious, since that statement itself depends on consciousness, therefore we can ask, in the last line, it says, katam, how, aprakashaha, well, this is tricky here. Prakasha is used in two different senses. In fact, the word prakasha occurs four times in this verse. And the last time is different. Prakasha means shining. The last use of prakasha we'll take it very carefully. Aprakasha means not shining. But not shining here refers to ignorance. In a technical sense, that which is shining is consciousness. That which is not shining is insentient. It is jada. It is material. And in a very Vedantic sense, ignorance and the effects of ignorance. The whole world, which is jada, is understood as an effect of ignorance. Ignorance in the sense of maya, but let us not go deeply into that. So I'm trying to explain why how this word aprakasha is used here. And the simple way of understanding aprakasha here is just ignorance. So prakasha in the sense of consciousness or intelligence, aprakasha in the sense of ignorance. Katam, how, aprakashaha, how can ignorance, the person who says, I'm not conscious? So the question is, katam, how, aprakashaha, how could that person's ignorance, born of dementia, sprashet, how could it affect swaprakasham tamatmanam? How could it affect atmanam, one's true self, which is swaprakasham, self-shining conscious? So how could ignorance affect the consciousness which is your true nature. Let me put the whole verse together for you, and you'll see the meaning very clearly. So the enlightened person who gets dementia, the mind will be filled with perhaps such ignorance and delusions that the mind could have the thought, I am not a conscious being. Na prakasheham. The mind, but that thought, na prakasheham, I am not a conscious being, that thought belongs to the mind, correct? That thought belongs to the mind. That thought is revealed by consciousness. That's what the second line says. Prakashana bandhana. That thought depends on consciousness. And the last half says, the consciousness because of which that thought, that ignorant thought, ignorance-based thought that I don't exist as a conscious being, the consciousness that illumines that thought, katam sprashet, how could it be affected, aprakashaha, by the ignorance in that demented mind? How could what be affected? Svaprakasham tamatmanam, how could one's own true conscious nature be affected? Consciousness isn't affected. The mind is affected. This is very clear. The mind is affected by Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. Consciousness isn't affected. Now, if you say, but then what is enlightenment? What we would say, and this is a little subtle, but you can get it. Consciousness is unchanging. Does consciousness get enlightened? Is consciousness in a condition of bondage and then consciousness becomes enlightened? Those are changes of condition. Consciousness was never bound. Consciousness does not become enlightened. Bondage and enlightenment is for the mind. Mana eva manushyanam karanam bandha moksha yoho. A few of you know that famous quote. That bondage and liberation are for the mind alone. And here's the point. Consciousness was never bound, never liberated. The mind is subject to suffering when due to ignorance. The teachings of Vedanta can remove that ignorance and free the mind from that suffering. But if that mind is defective, first of all, if the mind is defective early on, this knowledge will never take place in the first place. A mind that is really defective, that mind can never gain this Vedantic wisdom, that mind can never break free from ignorance and become enlightened, become free from suffering. So that defective mind cannot be helped by Vedanta if it's defective before. Suppose the mind is defective after. A person gets enlightened, the mind is freed from ignorance due to the teachings of Vedanta, but then that mind, due to Alzheimer's, due to dementia, that mind, the technical term is the mind loses the jnana pala. Pala, the fruits of the jnana, of this Vedantic wisdom. The mind loses the fruits of this Vedantic wisdom. That is a fact. Dementia is such a terrible disease. Yet, how does that affect consciousness? And that's the point of this verse. If that were to happen, if an enlightened person were to suffer from Alzheimer's and the mind loses everything, consciousness is not affected whatsoever. The personality is deeply affected, and dementia is a terrible disease. But the author points out, consciousness remains utterly unaffected. We'll continue next time. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha, sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, makaschadukabhagbhavet asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityor ma hamratangamaya om shanti 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 om tat sat.